Originally, it was called the Dull Band because of its so-called resemblance to a turban. And then it was called the Tulbent in Turkey. And then it was called the Tulipe in France. And then, in the 1570s, it was called the Tulpe. Today, we call it the Tulip.
Ben, so you're telling me it's not because it resembles two lips pursed together?
Apparently, you know, all this is in the eye of the beholder, Noel, but in this case, the name comes from the resemblance to a turban.
That's right, because it came from the continent of Asia, right?
It did. It came from Western Asia, from Turkey. And the earliest known instance of a tulip flowering in cultivation, they were just growing wild beforehand, is in 1559. A guy named Johann Heinrich Herwart grew the tulip. I don't know if you're a fan of flowers or if our super producer, Casey Pegram, is a fan himself.
Well, Casey Pegram is a flower in the desert, as far as I'm concerned.
A rose in the concrete.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So what about you, Noel? Are you, would you say you're pro-flower?
Well, I am, but I kill them. So I am more of a succulent guy because they're a little more sturdy, shall we say, aka a little more resilient, and I don't kill them quite as often, but I still manage.
Yeah, succulents will be more hardy for sure. I always thought one of the toughest flowers to grow was the orchid. I only know one person who has a magic touch with orchids, and that's my mother. I don't know how she does it.
It's because she's made of magic, Ben.
She's made of magic, perhaps, and she would be making a mint, allegedly, had she gone into the tulip game at a certain point in time. Because nowadays, it's pretty easy to buy tulips. You could go to your local nursery. You can go to your local, even a hardware store will have some tulips for sale often.
Yeah, like I think a dozen or so bulbs I found online for about $18 or something. And, you know, that's for every possible type of variety you could think of. We are talking about a time where the price of tulip bulbs just went completely bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely bananas.
So I propose we tackle today's episode in the following way. Let's tell the story that's most familiar to everyone, and then let's, after that, see how much of this stacks up, you know, what the fact and the fiction actually are.
That's the only way to do it, Ben.
Yeah. All right. So in the early 17th century, the Dutch Republic experienced what a lot of people will tell you was the first example of an economic boom and bust, right? We know about this kind of stuff here in the U.S. today with the housing bubble that burst in 2008. We know about this in various other points in time, but people will tell you that the Dutch Republic in the early 17th century, the 1600s, experienced the very first recorded economic bust. And it was called Tulip Mania.
Tulip Mania.
Tulip Mania. So what happened exactly?
Well, it all revolves around the idea of speculation. Speculation being predicting what something will be worth in the future and placing your bets that it will be worth that or more. And then the bottom drops out potentially when that speculative price reaches completely disproportionate heights with the thing itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. It all of a sudden becomes overvalued, or people realize it's overvalued.
And for a series of reasons that we'll get into.
Yes, yeah, for a series of reasons that can vary depending on the specific cases. In the case of tulips, essentially the way you'll hear this story pitched is that people in the Dutch Republic went absolutely bonkers for tulips, began paying exorbitant rates for them, that it gripped the country, and then eventually, that's the sound of a bubble popping. But how did we get here? What made tulips so popular?
Well, it starts earlier than this fellow, but he's kind of the main dude that really introduced tulip culture into the Netherlands. His name was Corlys Clusius, and he created a very, very influential garden at the University of Leiden, and that was in the late 1500s. He started this kind of tradition among horticulturists, which became kind of a gentlemanly pursuit of trading, you know, clippings and seeds and all kinds of, you know, tulip-related things, bulbs, between each other in the interest of kind of spreading this tradition around. But it was within a very small set of very particular types of learned individuals, right? Mm-hmm. But then it kind of started getting a little bit out of control. And instead of just doing trades, these folks who had the tulip bulbs started charging money for them. And then members of the merchant class, for example, who wanted to flaunt their newfound wealth, because this was kind of a relatively new class mm-hmm. of people that could afford the finer things in life in this part of the country, they were experiencing boom times. They decided they wanted to get in on this craze because these flowers were very beautiful, and some of them in particular that had kind of miscolored, discolorations almost, mm-hmm. they were even more desirable.
They were like rare Pogs or Pokemon.
Exactly.
And you have to catch them all. Yeah, so this guy, Carolus Clusius, got this whole craze going around 1593, and tulips had several strong advantages that set them apart from other flowers of the time. First, and we need to emphasize this, as you said earlier, Noel, they had these intense colors that other plants in the area just didn't have. Secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, it turns out that tulips can grow pretty well in this climate. This area, the Dutch Republic, doesn't have very good soil for, you know, most of the country. And it turns out that tulips love what is called poor soil. So not only can you have these beautiful, striking flowers, but you can actually grow them in a successful manner in a place where, you know, a lot of other flowers wouldn't grow.
Here's the thing, though, Ben. I didn't know this at all. Tulips take a really long time to grow.
It's true.
Yeah. So you can do it with seeds, but seeds, tulips grown from seeds, take like up to 6 or 7 years to grow. Mm-hmm. And then you have, I guess, what would be the same as like making a clone of any other type of plant, but it's a bulb. I guess it's called an offshoot, I believe, Ben. Mm. And those only take 3 or 4 years, maybe even 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. And that was what people wanted. And here's the thing that's also interesting about this whole story is that it kind of introduced some of the concepts surrounding futures trading.
Right.
Because you're not buying a full-grown tulip because you can't uproot a full-grown tulip or it will die. You have to wait until the summer when they go dormant. They literally go back down into mm-hmm. these bulbs, and only then can you dig them up. So people, these merchants, these aristocrats, these whomever that were just going wild for these tulips had to buy the promise of a future tulip.
Right. They would sign contracts before a notary to buy tulips at the end of the dormant season, which was from June to roughly September. That's when you could actually pull them out of the ground. And because of this, the Dutch, who had already developed a lot of techniques of modern finance, created this durable goods futures market for tulip bulbs. And it went insane pretty quickly, you know, because you're not buying tulips today, you're buying tulips tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll gladly pay you mm-hmm. Tuesday for a hamburger today, only mm-hmm. the other way around.
And then when you hear that other people in the market are paying increasingly extravagant prices, then you start to move with the market as well. Whether you are selling, whether you are buying, whether you are just trading tulip futures.
Yeah, and let's remember, too, that these were not native to the Netherlands, and so they were already relatively scarce because mm-hmm. they take so long to grow. They weren't just overflowing, right? There was a scarcity and a rare quality to them, and that is what drives that kind of gotta-have-them-all mentality, right?
Yeah.
If anyone could have them, no one would care.
Right, exactly. Kind of like hammer pants in the 1980s. I don't know. I think we're both too young to really deliver that reference. I just remember MC Hammer. So we said 1593. This is when it starts catching on. The early adopters, right? The learned fans of flowerdom and horticulture start buying up tulips. By 1633, in some transactions, tulip bulbs actually replace currency. Historian Mike Dash found documentation of actual properties being sold for what he said were handfuls of tulip bulbs. And then more and more people heard these sort of friend of a friend of a friend stories about someone who got into the market, bought and sold tulips, and now they're set for life. And by that same year, 1633, when this stuff is really escalating, a single bulb of a tulip variety called Semper Augustus was already worth 5,500 guilders.
Yeah, and Semper Augustus is that one with the stripes. It's got kind of red flame-like stripes on it. And this is super interesting. It turns out that the what causes that condition is actually a virus.
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
And no one knew how to breed them to, I mean, no, breed's not the right word, cultivate them to look like that. So they tried all kinds of crazy stuff, didn't they, Ben?
Yeah, they tried a ton of very strange things. They would, let's see, what was one of them? They buried it in a certain type of mud.
Yeah, there was pigeon dung, I believe, or pigeon guano, whatever you want to call it.
Pigeon poop.
Poop, there you go. That's the right word. That's the science. That's a science word. They also would even tie like a red and a white together and then bury them in the hopes that they would somehow commingle and
some
create,
sort of tulip osmosis.
Very much so. My favorite is they would sprinkle the soil with pigments that they would hope would somehow seep into the soil. And, you know, they didn't know what they were doing.
No, but they were just trying different things.
Exactly.
I mean, I think most people at the time would have made similar attempts. Those are just a few examples we know of, but we know that there were many other techniques, most of which were cartoonish failures. And this just made these failures just made the specific types of high-end tulips even more appealing. Now we see the market exploding. You would think maybe that by 1633, someone would have looked around, seen a Semper Augustus bulb, and said, "I don't think this is really worth 5,500 guilders." But no. The bubble kept growing.
Yeah, and we actually had situations where these deals were being made in back rooms of like inns and pubs and stuff, and it was all pretty organized. They apparently were these smoke-filled rooms where people were getting their drink on and their smoke on, and they had like these pieces of wood that they would write. They would essentially bid on these tulip lots, and it was like, I don't know. I saw this fantastic video series on YouTube that I was telling you about, Ben, that I think you had seen too, on a channel called Economics Decoded, and the guy, I don't see his name here. He doesn't really announce himself or lower third himself, but he does a fantastic job with illustrations and sound effects, and I really recommend checking it out. He does a three-part series on Tulip Mania, and he likens it to if when we had to go and buy a stock, if we had to literally have a conversation with a bunch of dudes in a smoky room and arrive at an agreed-upon price. Because we take for granted how quickly information travels these days and how the price of things are just set. It's understood by algorithm.
Or they change it in almost uniform manner.
Totally uniform. Whereas this was like a series of mini markets in different parts of the country that were pretty isolated because you could only get information to another part as fast as a guy could ride there on a horse, right?
Exactly. That's true. That's something that we can easily forget in the modern age of microsecond transactions and AI, quote unquote, helping people trade stocks. So the way the story goes is that this craze continues. By 1635, you could see records of 40 bulbs, just 40 bulbs, being sold for 100,000 guilders or florins. And by way of comparison, at that time, in the same year, 1 ton of butter cost around 100 guilders. And someone who was a pretty skilled laborer, someone who practiced a trade of some sort, like a blacksmith or a farrier or something, they might earn as much as 150 to 350 guilders a year. So this is a massive amount of money involved. And I really enjoy the part in the Tulip Mania series on Economics Decoded, where he walks us through the strange occurrence of February 1637. At this point, the price of a single Semper Augustus bulb that was worth 5,500 guilders in 1633 is easily worth 10,000 guilders. The center cannot hold. Things are going to fall apart, right? That's not what Chinua Achebe was talking about in his book, but you can see how this applies. And so, according to the story, the tulip market crashes very, very quickly, and people start to renege on those contracts that they had signed. So someone would say, look, you owe me this much money for these tulips, and they would just refuse to pay.
Yeah, and they got into a real sticky situation where the sellers had the tulips now at that delivery period where they'd gotten them out of the ground, mm-hmm. and there's only a limited amount of time before they are going to not be viable anymore, that they have to rebury them, but nobody's like accepting them. People are like, no, I don't want them. I'm not going to pay you. And I think small claims court got involved where right. they had to essentially get the courts to help them come up with a system of, you know, repayment that was agreeable by both parties and ended up being a small percentage
like
of
3%
of the price promised or whatever. Because again, these futures, and again, this wasn't really exactly futures trading. It was sort of like some of the same style of economics as futures trading, but futures trading has protections built in that this just didn't. And this is kind of just like the Wild West. And so you wouldn't pay full price, and you'd get like a deal because you're taking on risk. Your tulip might not turn out, and you don't get to just say, "Oh, my tulip didn't turn out. I'm not going to pay for it." That's technically not allowed, even though that's kind of what these people were doing, but it wasn't about the tulip not turning out. It was more about the whole system kind of falling
yeah.
apart. And but you don't pay full price. You pay a little bit less because you're soaking up some of that risk for the grower.
Yeah, yeah. And there's an interesting step here that I want to make sure we don't miss. Because of the precipitous rise, the price of tulips, most speculators by 1637 couldn't afford to buy even the cheapest tulips. And this is what triggered the collapse in demand. And then when the demand disappeared, the flowers quickly became worth maybe 10% of what they had been worth the day or the week before. And this sounds funny. This sounds like some sort of Dr. Seuss parable, but the real-time effect and the real-life effect of this is that people encountered financial catastrophe. People's lives were ruined when the tulip trade collapsed. And as you said, with the courts getting involved, these vicious fights over debt continued for years and years and years. And thus, the tulip boom and bust of the Dutch Republic became one of the most well-known financial cautionary tales in the Western world until about 1980, when people realized that there might be more to the story, because it turns out that the story we just relayed to you, Ridiculous Historians, is primarily based on a work of a Scottish journalist named Charles Mackay. In 1841, he wrote a book called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. He sourced his story about this tulip boom and bust from a guy named Johann Beckmann, who in 1797 wrote a book called A History of Inventions, Discoveries, and Origins. And then Beckmann's story, we trace this back, comes from three anonymous pamphlets that were published in 1637, the same year everything went to pot, and they were hit pieces.
Ben is slicing the air like a knife with his hand right now because he feels very strongly about this. And I agree, for a good reason. Hit pieces indeed, because he had an axe to grind. He did not like the practice of speculation at all. And neither did Mackay. And even today, this idea of futures is considered amoral by many, and it's a lot of it is felt to be a type of gambling because you're making bets on things that you don't actually own.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You're taking this piece of paper that says, I own the idea of this thing, what does not yet exist, and then you're selling it to somebody else for an inflated price based on this imaginary number that keeps getting higher and higher and higher. It's sort of like subprime mortgages, for example, where you keep betting on something and people don't fully understand, you know, what the market is going to do. And then it does a thing that no one quite saw coming. And then all of a sudden, all those bets you made, you got to pay them, but nobody has the money to pay them.
Yeah. the research was not done. And at least in the subprime mortgage crisis, there is overwhelming evidence that several people knew exactly what was happening and just decided to let it happen.
Oh, because you can make money. That's the thing right. about bubbles, right?
Yeah.
If you ride it out at the right time, you ride that wave correctly, mm-hmm. you can make a lot of money.
And we see other examples of this. Beanie Babies, that's an example. Pogs. I was talking off air a while back with Casey about Bitcoin. Casey, do you remember Bitcoin?
I do remember Bitcoin, yes.
Are you involved? Are you a Bitcoiner?
No. I got out of Bitcoin a long time ago. So, no, I don't have a stake in Bitcoin anymore.
But didn't you get out like a little too early?
I did indeed, yeah. I bought when it was like maybe like a dollar or something per Bitcoin. And then at its height, it was worth some crazy amount, like maybe close to $20,000 of Bitcoin. But I sold when it was far less than that. There's like a lot of people who have parked way too much money in Bitcoin who have lost mm-hmm. a lot over the last several months.
It's really interesting. It's a really interesting kind of comparison.
And there are more Bitcoins on the market, right?
So, oh, yeah. There's like Ethereum. There's a bunch. Yeah, there's
Dogecoin.
Yeah, yeah. There's all these weird like meme coins. And mm-hmm. there's one I was reading about called Stablecoin, which is literally just pegged to the U.S. dollar. So it's kind of like, what's even the point? But apparently the idea is you can kind of, I don't know, launder money with it or something. So, you know.
Oh, good.
The world of crypto. Yeah.
So we do see an interesting comparison there. We also know that the tulip story itself, the story of tulip mania, may have been a case of people playing telephone throughout history based on essentially works of propaganda that were anti-speculative, anonymously published pamphlets. Mm-hmm. And this means that we have more research ahead of us. There are some wonderful books about tulip mania. There are two that are both called Tulip Mania, right? And the authors of these books will assure you and assure us that the phenomenon was actually exaggerated, that contrary to what McKay says, it was not a situation wherein every single person on the nation, from paupers to royalty, were losing their minds and gouging their eyes out to buy more tulips.
Because I learned something in this research is that the Dutch more or less invented the model for the modern stock exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So it would certainly make sense that this was something that happened in their neck of the woods. And they also, you know, were a huge trading empire. And they established New York City and all of, you know, the Dutch East India Trading Company and all of that. I mean, it was definitely in their national identity.
Right. Like Harlem is originally a town in the Netherlands.
Harlem is where the infamous collapse of the market supposedly happened mm-hmm. during that that auction where nobody bid.
Yeah, that's Harlem with two A's.
That's right. And another thing that I want to point out, too, from that video series we mentioned, the guy in that video series points out something that I think should not be ignored, is that gambling was another huge part of their national consciousness. People would make bets on the craziest things. I think he points out one about a guy who bet that he could ford a river in a tiny wooden barrel or like a trough or something like that. And I believe it was Rembrandt, the famous painter, who bet on whether he'd be alive the next year or not. So, I mean, it was definitely a thing that was very popular. So it's almost like, you know, why not? Let's bet on tulips. And also, we haven't mentioned the fact that the plague was a big part of this, and people's life expectancy was very short.
Around 40.
Yeah, it was kind of like YOLO. Let's do this.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and with these important instrumental pieces of context, we can unpack a little bit of the fact versus fiction around tulip mania. We mentioned people did have their lives ruined financially at the time. That is true, but it may have been far fewer people than McKay would have us believe. In fact, some researchers have found fewer than half a dozen people who experienced financial trouble in that time period during the tulip boom and bust. And you'll hear people argue that although prices had risen, money had not actually changed hands between buyers and sellers, so the profits were never realized for the sellers unless they had made other purchases on credit, expecting their tulip money to come in sometime between June and September. So the collapse in prices, the argument goes, did not actually cause a ton of people to lose real tangible money. Just had a series of interesting, increasingly desperate conversations.
Yeah, it's actually really cool that we got to do this story because I just the other day was asking my girlfriend's stepdad, he's a big Scotch fan, mm-hmm. and I was something I've always wondered, I asked him, was how is it sustainable to have these scotches that you age for 20, 30 years or whatever and have that be viable when you need to be selling product right away? And I think I'm explaining this right, but it was another form of futures where you have a certain elite that are investing in barrels, investing in particular lots or whatever of the good stuff, the really long-aged kind of fancy stuff that they do in smaller batches in order to finance the quicker turnaround product. And I just thought that was really interesting that this is a very similar example to that. Like, how do you take something that requires years to actually generate a tangible thing and make that a market where people are actually going to pay into it? And that's how you do it. It's very similar to with whiskey.
Yeah. Wine would be another great comparison, I believe. This story, while it does seem to have a cautionary aspect to it, and while it does seem to be sort of a morality tale— we know that it's been exaggerated. It hasn't been completely made up. This really did happen. And I would say that this means it still functions as a crucial lesson in these, our modern days. Don't buy tulips for too much money. You know what I mean? And we have to be very cognizant and very self-aware of groupthink and group panics. Mm-hmm. Something like this will come along every so often.
Oh, and another interesting little tidbit I picked up along the way is that what happens when you start increasing supply over years in a market that relies on scarcity to create the actual value of the thing itself? All of a sudden, it ain't so scarce anymore. And then people are like, well...
Well, here's another example that's tangentially related, and that's a good point, Noel. OPEC recently met to reduce production of petroleum. And they did that not because they were worried about running out of reserves, but because the price globally of oil fell too low for their liking. And now, technically speaking, the U.S. is, depending on how you measure it out, the U.S. is the world's largest producer.
Interesting.
Right.
And that's weird. Where futures really come into play today is with things like oil, like absolutely necessary, tangible goods.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
As opposed to tulips, which are kind of like frivolous. And have you heard that that Monty Python sketch about the lupins?
Oh, yeah.
Dennis Moore?
I think Gabe Hipp reminded me of that one, too.
Maybe we should go out on that because it's such a fun reminder of how absurd this whole story really is.
Let's do that. That's a good idea. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. We want to hear your opinions on other economic crazes. And if you had fun listening, let us know. In lieu of sending us tulips, why not head over to our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians, or drop by Apple Podcast and give us a rating.
Right now, my fine friends, no false moves, please. I want you to hand over all the lupins you've got.
Lupins?
Yes, lupins. Come on, come on.
What do you mean, lupins?
Don't try and play for time.
I'm not. You mean the flower lupins?
That's right.
Well, we haven't got any lupins.
Honestly?
Look, my fine friends, I happen to know that this is the Lupin Express.
You must be out of your tiny mind.
Get out the coach.
Well, so much for the lupins.
Dennis Moore, galloping through the sward. Dennis Moore, and his horse Concord. He steals from the rich and gives to the poor. Mr. Moore. Mr.
Here we are.
Moore,
I'll be back.
Mr. Moore.